This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here, we enlighten you with the ayah 61 of Surah Yunus, recited by Ahmad Mirza Devaghifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وما تكون في شأن وما تتلو منه من قرآن وما تتلو وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا في السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا في كتاب مبين وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا في السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. And you are not engaged in any affair, nor do you recite concerning it any portion of the Quran, nor do you do any work, but we are witnesses over you when you enter into it. And there does not lie concealed from your Lord the weight of an atom in the earth or in the heaven, nor anything less than that, nor greater. But it is in a clear book.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news. What you heard was an IRIB English Radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The headlines, Russia says, U.S. plans to train Ukrainian troops to use Patriot missiles confirms Washington's de facto participation in the Ukraine war. Peru's Attorney General launches a preliminary investigation against President Boluarte on charges of genocide, homicide, and serious injuries. And French trade unions call for strikes and protests after the government announces plans to raise the retirement age. Our top story for this half hour, the United States says it plans to begin training Ukrainian forces at a military base in Oklahoma on how to use and maintain Patriot missile systems.
I can confirm that training for Ukrainian forces on the Patriot air defense system will begin as soon as next week at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. The training will prepare approximately 90 to 100 Ukrainian soldiers to operate, maintain, and sustain the defensive system over a training course expected to last several months. And once fielded, the Patriot will continue to contribute to Ukraine's air defense capabilities and provide another capability to the Ukrainian people to defend themselves against Russia's ongoing aerial assaults.
The Russian ambassador to Washington has reacted to the U.S. decision. Anatoly Antonov says the move is another proof of the U.S. de facto participation in the conflict. Antonov added that Washington's goal is to inflict as much damage as possible on Russia. On the battlefield, this is yet another sign of tension between Russia and the West. On Tuesday, the Secretary of Russia's Security Council and a close aide to President Vladimir Putin said his country is now fighting the NATO in Ukraine. Nikolai Patrushev said the events in Ukraine are not a clash between Moscow and Kiev, but a military confrontation between Russia and NATO. Since the beginning of the war in February, Western countries have been supplying weapons and military equipment to Ukraine to help it fight Russia. We're now joined by Johnny Miller, who's with us now from Crimea. Johnny, it's great to have you with us. Please tell us, give us a better understanding about what this recent development means overall in the Ukraine conflict.
Well, of course, this is another tranche of weapons that the United States has promised to Ukraine. It's interesting that they say it'll take several months to train these soldiers in these Patriot systems, an indication that NATO is in this war, is pursuing their policies for the long term. Indeed, there's a feeling here amongst Russian people that they are resigned to the likelihood that this conflict will go on for years. This conflict, of course, has three elements. It's first of all a civil war between Ukrainian nationalists who took power in 2014 and its culturally Russian-speaking Russian population. It's also an attempt by Russia to, as it sees it, secure its geostrategic security, particularly Crimea. And then it's also an attempt by NATO countries to damage Russian power. And that's very much what we're seeing here with the supply of these weapons. That's understood in policy circles, but it's a discourse, it's an argument, a debate that's not really allowed in mainstream discourse in NATO countries. So at the moment, on the battlefield, we're seeing some of the heaviest fighting in Ukraine around Bakhmut and Soledar. News just come in that Soledar has just been taken by the Russians, so they are moving forward in the Donbass at the moment. But this new news makes it clear that NATO countries are going to continue in their policy and try to win this war on the battlefield. Meanwhile, there's also a growing debate among some Europeans about whether Europeans should be continuing to support this war. This war is, in many ways, not just about Ukraine, but it's a conflict between the unipolar world and the emerging multipolar world. And European governments at the moment seem determined to risk the living standards of their own people, indeed the output of their own industry, in order to prop up US global hegemony. So NATO at the moment very much paying with weapons and funding to Ukraine, but on the battlefield, dozens, most likely hundreds of soldiers are dying every day, and Ukrainians are paying in blood.
Johnny, where does that leave the prospects of talks and resolving this through dialogue at this point in time?
Well, as we enter 2023, peace looks further away than it ever has been, frankly. The beginning of this war, there was discussions between, even negotiations between the Ukrainians and the Russians. They were sidelined, and now there seems to be very little pushing for peace from either side. I think there's a lot of mistrust as well on the Russian side. They seem to feel that the only way they can win now is on the battlefield. And with these new announcements by NATO, it seems there was some hope that as winter came, there would be more pressure by European governments as the energy crisis took hold, but it doesn't seem like that's going to happen. So at the moment, peace is a long way off. Both sides focus very much on the battlefield, and that's why we're seeing some of the heaviest fighting we have. As I said, dozens, hundreds of soldiers killed or wounded every day in some of those brutal fighting that we've seen in this war so far, indeed in Europe, of course, for decades.
All right, thanks a lot. Johnny Miller joining us from Crimea. U.S. House Republicans vote to create a new committee to investigate President Joe Biden's, quote, weaponization of the federal government. The GOP lawmakers use their new slim majority in the lower chamber to pass the resolution. The body is set to launch a wide-ranging probe of the Justice Department, FBI, and other federal agencies investigating former President Donald Trump. Democrats quickly slammed the panel creation. They said it was an attempt by Republicans to shut down ongoing investigations into the January 2021 Capitol protests and Trump's handling of classified documents. On Monday, the White House said lawyers for Biden found classified documents at a Washington think tank affiliated with the president. Republicans have called for a thorough investigation into the matter. And the United States' top companies are now laying off employees at levels not seen since the 2008 Great Financial Crisis. The World Bank now forecasts that the U.S. will just barely avoid recession this year, meaning the job cuts may only be starting. Rami Mazzari has more on the story from Chicago.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street to the cryptocurrency sector, but also from Amazon to McDonald's, seemingly every day sees a new announcement of thousands of layoffs. Strikes to preserve jobs, once rarely seen and rarely reported on, are increasing nationwide. But it's hard to precisely say how bad unemployment will get because there is increasing admission that the official jobless statistics are willfully inaccurate. Full-time job offers have plunged, while part-time work, which pays less and offers few benefits like health care, have soared. But the increase in part-time work continues to count towards full employment to give the United States an official unemployment rate of 3.5%.
The BLS, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, according to them, if you are a discouraged worker, if you stop looking for work, you no longer count for the unemployment data. If you are a gig worker, you also don't count in the unemployment data. So already that lets you know that the data is skewed.
Many believe that when the nation's top bankers know that their sustained hike in interest rates are guaranteed to produce layoffs and recession, then it's clear that fiscal policy isn't aimed at protecting the lower and middle classes. The near certainty of high unemployment long term caused a small group of progressives in Congress to accuse the Fed of having, quote, an apparent disregard for the livelihoods of millions of working Americans. President Joe Biden has allowed the pandemic era's successful and unprecedented monetary redistribution policies to lapse, throwing many households and children back into poverty amid the inflation-related instability.
Prior to the pandemic, 140 million people were at the poverty line or below, and all the policies such as the child tax credit, which was proven to take children out of poverty, was done away with, right? If it's been proven to actually, you know, mitigate child poverty, why was it eradicated, right? So, you know, the economy, you know, it's like the same thing in any type of class society, right? There's always two sides, for the rich and for the rest of us.
The Washington-based lender, the World Bank, just slashed their growth outlook for the global economy by half, predicted that one-third of the world will fall into recession this year, and said the United States will have a growth rate of just 0.5%. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Well, Peru is launching a preliminary investigation into President Dina Boluarte on charges of genocide, homicide, and serious injuries. The country's attorney general said Prime Minister Alberto Otarola and the Defense and Interior Ministers will also be investigated. This shortly after the Prime Minister announced a three-day nighttime curfew in the southern region of Puno, running from 8 p.m. to 8 a.m. local time. On Monday, 18 people, including one police officer, were killed in clashes between police and demonstrators. The death toll in a month of protests against the ouster of President Pedro Castillo has risen to 40. The government has defended the actions of security forces, claiming the protests amount to a, quote, organized coup attempt. Protesters want early elections, resignation of the new president, and closure of Congress. They also wanted the ousted president released. Castillo was arrested after being removed from office in December. And French unions are mobilizing to strike after President Emmanuel Macron's government announced plans to raise the retirement age.
Suite à l'annonce de la réforme gouvernementale.
All the trade union organizations met immediately to build a common response of interprofessional mobilization. This will take place in the form of a first day of strikes and demonstrations on January 19, 2023.
Well, the comments were made after Prime Minister Elizabeth Borne proposed raising the legal retirement age from 62 to 64 by 2030 in a major reform to the pension system. That sets the stage for a bitter fight and weeks of disruption nationwide. Unions have called the reform one of the most brutal measures in the past 30 years. Opinion polls show around two-thirds of the French people oppose raising the retirement age. The country is now grappling with high inflation. Well, UK workers from different sectors have been staging strikes since the summer of 2022 to demand an increase in their wages at par with inflation. But the government is not only refusing to budge, but trying to make it harder for workers to go on strike. We discuss the issue in our news review program. Let's have a listen.
The British government has introduced a bill to Parliament designed to curb the impact of strikes over pay that continue to paralyze services across the nation.
So I'm introducing a bill that will give government the power to ensure that vital public services will have to maintain a basic function by delivering minimum safety levels, ensuring that lives and livelihoods are not lost. Mr. Speaker, we're looking at six key areas, each of them critical for keeping the British people safe and society functioning. These are health, education, fire, rescue, transport, border security, and nuclear decommissioning. We do not want to use this legislation, but we must ensure the safety of the British public. During the passage of the bill, we intend to consult on what an adequate level of coverage looks like in fire, ambulance, and in rail services. For the other sectors covered in the bill...
Unions have described the bill as undemocratic and unworkable, urging lawmakers to reject it. The bill will not be debated on Tuesday and could take months to become law. The opposition Labour Party says it will repeal the law if it comes to power in a national election expected next year. Britain's experiencing a wave of industrial actions, with workers demanding wages in tandem with rising inflation, which is now around 40-year highs. Nurses, ambulance staff, and rail workers are among those who have staged walkouts. And so far, talks between the government and trade unions have failed to produce a breakthrough. Okay, to explore the reasons for this and get some insight, I'm joined by Saeed Purizam, my colleague in London. Now, Saeed, tell us on what ground the unions are rejecting this bill, that the government seems like the government likes it.
Well, what the unions are saying that this, what the government is calling its minimum services bill or legislation, is in fact an anti-strike piece of legislation aimed at weakening the union movement, but preventing the unions from really having the impact that they want on the government to get the government to meet their demands, giving the employers the ability to sue unions, the ability to sack employees if they refuse to work during the time of industrial action, basically rendering strike action ineffectual, ineffective. And as we heard Grant Shapps say in that soundbite earlier, that is going to impact several key sectors such as the NHS, the railway, as well as education. This is the so-called watered-down version of the bill that was introduced during the short premiership of former Prime Minister Liz Truss under Jacob Rees-Mogg, the former business secretary that had put down a stricter threshold for a strike to take place. The government has said that it will drop that because it feared it would... It feared legal action by the unions against the government. The reaction, again, from the new unions has been furious, especially because this comes only a day after those failed crisis talks between the unions and government ministers just yesterday. And they're saying now, the unions are, that they are going to band together continue with their strike action to defend their workers, despite the fact that the government might find many different ways to, quote-unquote, attack them. The Labour Opposition Party has also come out saying that they will repeal this piece of legislation if elected into government in the next general election, having many people raising the question of what is really the point of this legislation if Labour is going to repeal it later on.
Okay, thank you so much for that. Saeed Purizam in London.
That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
and a supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate, praise belongs to Allah who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
In the U.S., thousands of people are without electricity in California as it braces for the next onslaught of storms. At least six people have died since New Year, and more than 560,000 homes are without power. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Los Angeles Times has covered the story and tells us more. California is bracing for another week of destructive storms that will probably bring flooding and hazardous winds on Monday to an already battered state. A series of atmospheric rivers that pummeled coastal communities last week and left more than 400,000 people without electricity in California on Sunday would be followed by particularly brutal weather as rivers reach flood levels and powerful winds wreak havoc, according to forecasters. We expect to see the worst of it in front of us, California Governor Gavin Newsom said on Sunday, 8th of January. We're anticipating very intense weather coming in on Monday and Tuesday morning. Governor Gavin Newsom asked the Biden administration to declare a federal emergency in California before the new weather arrives, saying that the most extreme conditions are expected in the first 48 hours of the week. Evacuation warnings or orders were issued in parts of Santa Clara, Alameda, Sacramento, Sonoma, Monterey, and Santa Cruz counties, with forecasters suggesting that swollen rivers could flood businesses and homes. San Jose officials were gearing up for what could be the worst flooding to hit the San Francisco Bay Area most populous city since the surprise flooding in 2017 of Coyote Creek, which forced more than 14,000 residents out of their homes. Water district officials warned of possible flooding in San Jose at the Guadalupe River near the Tamien station of the Caltrain commuter rail system, affecting the Northern Cross neighborhood, Ross Creek at Cherry Avenue south of downtown, and Upper Penitentia Creek near the North San Jose BART station. The Santa Clara Valley Water District on Sunday, 8th of January, issued an extreme weather alert. Flooding is possible in the coming days in Palo Alto, Menlo Park, Sunnyvale, Morgan Hill, and Gilroy, California. Evacuation warnings were issued downstream to two full reservoirs in Santa Clara County. The Uvas Reservoir, northwest of Gilroy, whose water flows into Uvas Creek, and the Pacheco Reservoir, which empties into Pacheco Creek alongside Highway 152, a main route between the San Francisco Bay Area and Interstate 5. Evacuation warnings in Santa Cruz County include the towns east and southeast of Santa Cruz, including Soquel, Sea Creek, Rio del Mar, and Watsonville, which borders the Pajaro River. Monterey County Sheriff Tina Nieto said the Carmel and Big Sur rivers will probably reach flood stage on Monday and the Salinas River on Tuesday. Evacuation warnings were issued along the Carmel Valley, where the Carmel River could flood. Alameda County issued evacuation warnings for the hills east of Hayward and Fremont and west of Pleasanton. Sacramento County issued an evacuation order for the Wilton area along the Consumers River, whose waters breached levees over New Year's Eve, killing three motorists whose bodies were found in or near submerged cars near Highway 99. As of Sunday afternoon, 8th of January, 424,000 customers were without electricity in California, according to the state's Office of Emergency Services. More than 375,000 customers lost their power in Northern California overnight on Saturday, 7th of January, as the latest powerful winter storm pushed through the region, elevating the danger for flooding and bringing intense winds that downed trees. In the Sacramento area, one of the hardest hit regions, wind gusts topped 60 miles per hour and caused many to lose their power, according to the National Weather Service. Utility officials have been working to restore electricity and said it will take some time. Pacific Gas and Electric deployed 4,000 crew members dedicated to storm restoration. Their own personnel, contractors, and mutual aid from Southern California and as far away as Wyoming and Canada. "We're just getting repeatedly pounded by storm after storm," said Tracy Correa Lopez, a spokeswoman for Pacific Gas and Electric. "Flooding is an issue. The number one issue right now is access to a lot of these areas." The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story and tells us more. Torrential downpours and damaging winds left hundreds of thousands of homes and businesses without electricity in California early on Sunday, 8th of January, as the area braced for the next onslaught of severe weather. More than 560,000 homes were reported to be still without electricity in California as of Sunday afternoon, according to data from PowerOutage.us. At least 6 people have died in the severe weather since New Year's weekend, including a toddler killed by a fallen redwood tree crushing a mobile home in Northern California. Forecasters have meanwhile warned yet another atmospheric river of dense, moist tropical air will clobber California on Monday, 9th of January, with rain and mountain snow. That weather is just the first of 5 approaching atmospheric rivers, a stream of storms that will continue until about 19th of January, and they will arrive in the state this weekend. An NWS weather alert on Saturday, 7th of January, warned that the cumulative effect of successive heavy rainstorms since late December could bring rivers to record high levels and cause flooding across much of Central California. The heavy recent rains have had a huge impact on the state and caused rivers and streams to overflow and send floods down streets and highways and submerging vehicles, homes and businesses. The storms have also whipped waves to historic heights along California's coastline. Drought-hit California had been on track for another dry winter until the stacked atmospheric rivers came into play. However, most experts believe that California will need a lot more water before the long-term drought could be considered meaningfully broken.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Palestinian athletes. Sports in Palestine faces a lot of obstacles that disturb the true essence of what sport is about. Under Israeli occupation for more than half a century, the industry of sport suffers greatly, just as the Palestinians themselves suffer daily.
We participated in several championships, including the Batna International Championship in Algeria. We also participated in the Arabic Championship and took 5th place. However, Palestine was deprived from participating in many external championships due to the Israeli siege that has been imposed for the past decade. In those 10 years, time goes by, along with the age of players, which means the end of their sporting career.
The Israeli occupation does not like to see Palestinian sports that represent the Palestinians as a civilian nation to the world with the ability to compete with other teams. The Palestinian athletes do not have immunity at all. Palestinian sports in general is not immune, whether in times of war or without war. You may find the Israeli warplanes shelling a sports club or stadium, arresting a player, or preventing a team from participating abroad.
And now, the national anthem of Palestine.
Sports for Palestinians could perhaps play a role in international forums, but the Israeli occupation does not want any positive attention to shine on the occupied territory, and so it oppresses sports development as a strategy to keep the international community away from the occupation's repressive activities.
For your information, in some championships, Israel imposed on the host nation not to raise any country's flag so that Palestine's flag would not be raised. However, in the last championship held in Australia, Israel was not able to dictate its preferences. So Palestine's flag was raised and the Palestinian anthem was played when the Palestinian team marched out on the grounds. This is considered an achievement for us.
Having Palestine's flag raised in the Asian Championships for the first time was a huge achievement. However, raising our flag in Australia is our biggest achievement, especially as we know Australia voted against Palestine 2 weeks before at the UN Assembly. Our nation has the right to have a state and live in peace. We deserve to live. Today we are among 16 Asian countries. Although our country is under siege and the most basic necessities do not exist, our national team is here today, among the teams of great countries like Japan, Iran, Australia, Korea, and others. When hearing the national anthem here in this stadium with the players and technical team, in which I am a member, with the rest of the Arab, Palestinian, and Asian audience, which supported our team to the finals, it gives you an indescribable feeling. This feeling comes because you're one of the soldiers who participated in raising the flag of your country in the international arena.
The Palestinian team qualified to the finals in the Asian Cup for the first time in history. The Asian Cup started in the 1960s. The Israeli occupation used to participate among other countries under the name of the State of Israel, as if Palestine did not exist. In 1970, a group of noble and honest Arabs expelled Israel from the Asian Football Confederation and replaced them with Palestine as a member. We regained our right to membership of the International Football Federation, in which we can participate in the World Cup. The occupation knows that sports creates a good image toward the Palestinian people, so it wants to sabotage it, destroy it, and hide it from the world. It wants to present the Palestinians to the world as terrorists.
For every athlete in Palestine, there is a sad tale of suppressed opportunity under the Israeli occupation, which deliberately puts obstacles before the Palestinian sporting industry to keep it behind closed doors.
One of the circumstances that helped me play football was living near Rafah Services Club and the UNRWA Club. I was able to get into the national junior team, the national youth team, then the Olympic team, and finally the national team. I received the best junior player title in the Palestinian League for the year 2005 to 2006. On July the 22nd, 2009, I was supposed to travel to the West Bank to join Balata Youth Center Club as a professional player at the boot camp of the national team in Al Farah. However, some other players and I were stopped, and I was arrested. I was the only one among them to be arrested, and without reason.
I was assigned to form the Palestinian Federation for Self-Defense Games, sponsored by the Paralympics Committee. This committee is specialized in training special needs athletes in order that they may participate in international championships and the Olympics. We received an invitation from the MRT Athlete Club to participate in the Dubai International Championship of 2016. We participated with a team of six players, one able female, an able male, and four visually impaired athletes. Our team competed strongly in this championship, and for the first time in Arab and Palestinian team, won third position and received a bronze medal. It feels great to raise the Palestinian flag and play the Palestine national anthem at such a championship. Upon our team's return back home, I was arrested by the Israeli police and detained for 5 hours, and the blind players were also held. My team insisted on not leaving without me. How could they leave when they have no one to guide them back home?
It's no coincidence that the arrest of Palestinian athletes has pushed a number of prisoners from the sports sector to to more than 70. This number refers to the expansion of deliberate targeting of promising sports champions by the occupation.
I was detained without charge for no other reason than for being a Palestinian athlete representing my country. I spent 3 years in the Israeli prisons. During my sentence period, I was interrogated from time to time and manipulated to try to make me confess to anything. But in the end, they had to let me go. It shows to what extent the Israeli intelligence had nothing on me. They wanted to prove that they did not just arrest a Palestinian athlete, but a terrorist from their view. They could not prove anything, so they released me after 3 years. I was released, but with many health problems, because I had gone on a hunger strike for 96 days. These problems prevented me from continuing my football career. I do not wish for any athlete to experience the same situation I faced.
Upon our arrival to the Erez, Beit Hanun checkpoint, we were supposed to have a press conference with a number of international journals and agencies. But to our surprise, I was arrested and the blind boys were held and pushed outside. I was held for 26 days in the interrogation cells at Ashkelon prison. They accused me of training terrorists. I responded, "If you say that these blind boys are terrorists, I wonder how you can call them terrorists." It was bizarre that the interrogator was watching some reports on YouTube about the team, and he knew that I was training these blind boys. They presented me with a number of trials, 5 trials consecutively. Each trial extended my arrest period. I was released after the last trial, innocent of all charges. I believe that the whole thing was for the purpose of disruption and killing of our happiness, so that the people in Gaza would not feel the joy of our success.
The case of Hassan al-Rai is not the first one. We have more than 70 to 80 cases like his. There is the case of Sami Ad-Daur, who was arrested simply for being a national team player, along with Fadi al-Sharif. Ayman and Nafadi received a medical transfer to have a crucial ligament operation. After his operation, he returned back to Gaza and was immediately arrested with his fresh injury. Beit Hanun Eretz checkpoint has become a daily arrest and interrogation point. Its purpose is to insult people. How could a country that presents itself as being a democratic state grant an entrance visa to someone and then arrest them?
Israeli violations were not limited to false arrests. They adhered to discriminatory policies of not issuing travel permits for players to participate in both domestic and international championships.
Athletics games are competitive. It requires capabilities. To become international, you need tremendous capabilities. It requires the potentials of countries, not individuals. Because of the siege on our country and the closure of the Rafah border crossing for the past 2 years now, Palestinian Rana Inas was not able to travel to participate in a championship in the UAE. She was not given a pass to travel across Eretz Point. Furthermore, she was supposed to participate in the Beit Lehem 10-kilometer marathon, but she did not get a checkpoint pass for that either.
We exercised hard to have our names included in the Bethlehem Championship, but because of not receiving a checkpoint pass, I was deprived from participating. I trained intensely for the 10-kilometer race for 2 months prior to the race, even though I knew I had no permission to pass. We practiced hard, and I think maybe we could have won first place in that competition.
As a trainer for the national team, I suffered a lot moving between the governorates to reach Ramallah to be with the Palestine national team. It was hard for the players I chose from the clubs in Gaza to reach the northern governorates, which affected the competitive level of the national team. It is hugely suffering for the athletes inside Palestine.
We could not get the majority of our players to the northern governorates because of the delay in getting checkpoint passes. On one hand, because these games have specific dates, and on the other hand, the permissions to pass were either denied or given after the expiration of the specific date of the games. So Gazan athletes did not participate in these games.
في هذه البطولات.
فلسطين في تصفيات كأس العالم 2010.
Palestine participated in the 2010 World Cup playoffs. According to the draw, we were supposed to face the team of Malaysia. As we do not have a home ground, we used to play our games outside Palestine. We were matched up with Malaysia in an away game. We were supposed to meet the team in Malaysia, but 3 days before the match, the Israeli occupation prevented the Palestinian team from leaving. This injustice was not confined to the Israeli occupation. FIFA too was unjust towards us when it issued a statement in which the Palestinian team was condemned for not participating.
Practically every country in the world has a unified football league, with the exception of Palestine, which is forcibly deprived of that right. So the Palestinian Football Union seeks to at least unite the West Bank and Gaza Strip leagues to try to address Israeli measures that impose separation between the West Bank and the Gaza Strip.
The occupation is what divides the Palestinian territories into smaller parts. I'm referring to the 1948 Palestinian territories. There are the northern governorates of the West Bank and the southern governorates of the Gaza Strip. We try as much as possible to unite these communities by holding local competitions with the Palestinian clubs in the governorates of our land.
We have a diaspora league, the West Bank League, and the Gaza League. The teams in Gaza are not permitted to meet the teams of the West Bank, nor the diaspora. I mean, Barcelona and Real Madrid can move throughout Spain, but in Gaza, its teams play only each other, and the teams within the West Bank play each other. So there is one champion in Gaza and one champion in the West Bank. We've been appealing to the world to pressure the occupation to allow our teams access across checkpoints. This appeal is 20 years old now. We've had 20 years of league championships in Gaza, which have all been kept separate from the West Bank championships.
When the Palestinian National Authority took over, there were many attempts to have one unified league between the West Bank and Gaza. However, the obstacle of not having to pass the district prevented players from coming together. This also resulted in poor communications between the athletes and teams from each area, so we had to come up with the compromise of having two leagues. One league includes the clubs of Gaza, the other includes the clubs of the West Bank. I hope one day the winners of the two districts can play each other.
For a quarter of a century, we've appealed, and I myself appealed to football officials associated with FIFA, which is to have one unified Palestinian league. We want a league similar to that of the USA, Russia, Britain, Spain, France, Germany, and all countries around the world. We want to establish a unified league that unites the West Bank and Gaza, but Israel stands against this.
Setting a precedent, the Palestinian Football Union in 2015 held a match between trophy champions of the West Bank and Gaza, despite all that was done by the occupation to prevent any such meeting.
In 2015, the winners of the Cup of Gaza, for the first time in 15 years, met up with the winners of the West Bank Cup. They met despite the will of the occupation because of the intervention of FIFA. The away game was held in Gaza, while the home game was held in the West Bank, and then we pronounced the outright winner.
قدر الاتحاد انه
The union decided to hold a match between the champions of the northern governorates and southern governorates so as to decide a unified champion that would represent Palestine in the Asian Games. The match was between the Shujaya Union Club, representing Gaza governorates, and Al Khalil Ahli Club, representing the West Bank. The Al Khalil Ahli Club won the championship.
We were excited, but Israel obstructed the event by arresting a number of players, and the Shabak Israeli Security Agency interrogated them for several hours. In addition to this, many players were refused a checkpoint pass. If it was not for the interference of FIFA and other countries, this sporting event would have not been held.
The escalation of violations by the occupying forces against Palestinian sports and athletes did not stop at international norms. Its momentum increased in the wars waged by the occupation on Gaza, the most violent of which occurred in the summer of 2014.
Palestine Stadium was shelled with a dozen bombs, each weighing about a ton. The stadium was completely destroyed. Not only the stands, but the whole field was unplayable. The Rafah Municipal Stadium was also shelled in 2008. This city has champion teams, but we've been unable to rebuild the stadium until now. Till now, I find it difficult as an athlete, a Palestinian, or even a follower of sports and current affairs to understand why the occupation would bombard playgrounds and sports clubs. We don't know the reason except to think that the occupation does not want to see any young Palestinian, especially athletes, to achieve greatness in sport or for them to play other Arab teams or internationally.
Rafah Stadium was one of the targets of Israel's military complex. We don't know why. It is just a stadium like any other around the world. Palestinian youth play in this stadium. It was, however, shelled with more than just one bomb by an F-16 warplane. The building and the grounds were completely destroyed. Now it is a playground without any stands. Of course, the field is not suitable to play on, but it is the only one that exists. Fragments of steel and rock can be still seen there. Many players stayed away from the stadium because of the bombardment.
Clubs were bombed, centers were bombed. More than 30 sports locations were bombed during the aggression on Gaza. There are no more than 5 stadiums, so the agenda of the General Federation of Football was affected dramatically. The capacity of other stadiums is limited, so by shelling these stadiums, from the Israeli perspective, it totally disrupts Palestinian sports.
The recent war on Gaza by the occupation's military exceeded every human standard and killed more than 27 Palestinian athletes. They joined the long list of victims who were athletes and martyred.
In the past 20 years, 400 or so Palestinian athletes have been martyred. These athletes are from all kinds of sporting backgrounds, football, volleyball, handball, and individual sports like martial arts. All of these sports lost memorable players. More than 400 Palestinian martyrs sacrificed their lives for the cause of Palestine. The Palestinian athlete is a Palestinian citizen before he or she is an athlete.
Israel deliberately targeted the sports sector as it did other sectors, such as health, social, and economics. We in the sports sector have 400 martyrs. At the top is Captain Ahad Zakout, who is one of our trainers. Many young players also were assassinated in the southern governorates. We as sports people are supposed to have immunity under international law to travel and participate, but Israel flouts these laws and international regulations.
On the morning of July 30, 2014, One Israeli war jet targeted a residential apartment with a rocket. The apartment was owned by the late athlete Ahed Zakut in the Al Nasser neighborhood in Gaza City, bringing an end to the life of an athlete who continues to inspire many even after his death.
I woke up to the voice of my mother screaming my name and my father's name, Khaled and Ahed. I went out and answered, "Here I am." She asked me where my father was. I say, "I don't know. I will look for him." She ran out of the house screaming for someone to help. The living room was on fire. A missile had hit the house, smashing walls and room and setting the living room on fire. My uncle was the first to enter our house.
I turned around and came into the house. The bedroom door was broken, blocking the entrance. I kicked it with my leg and was surprised to see Ahed lying under the separating wall between the bedroom and the living room. He was still breathing. His son then entered and started screaming.
We told him to bear witness that there is no God, but Allah and Muhammad is his messenger. In his last moments, he was opening his mouth and closing it. Then the ambulance came and took him to the hospital, but he was later taken to the cemetery.
Captain Ahed Zakut was the star player of the Palestinian National Football League. He was the star of Gaza Sports Club and played in many clubs inside Palestine. Then he became a trainer after retiring as a football player. He focused on the youth. Captain Ahed Zakut wanted Palestine to have a promising future. He focused on having a national Palestinian team that would qualify for the finals of the World Cup in 10 years' time. But it seems this dream did not appeal to Israel. The Israeli occupation focuses on how to hit us at the core.
Despite all the crimes committed by the occupation against Palestinian sports and athletes, they would not be able to achieve their aims to undermine the resolve of the aspiring athletes who hope to represent Palestine at international tournaments and to hold high the Palestinian flag in states that have ignored and still ignore Palestinian rights.
In the limelight.
More than 7,000 nurses at two major New York City hospitals walked off their jobs recently, arguing immense staffing shortages are causing widespread burnout and hindering their ability to properly care for their patients. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truth Out wrote in this regard, workers in the U.S. say understaffing and patient safety issues have forced them to go on a strike. Over 7,000 nurses across two hospitals in New York City went on a strike after contract negotiations broke down over the hospital's refusal to meet nurses' staffing demands. Nurses at Montefiore Medical Center in the Bronx and Mount Sinai in Manhattan walked out at 6 a.m. Monday, January 9th, saying they are forced to work long hours with huge workloads that leave them burnt out, which could potentially put patients in danger. The workers have been put in unfortunate position of having no other choice than to strike, said Mario Silento, president of the New York AFL-CIO, of which The New York State Nurses Association, NYSNA, is an affiliate. Now, nurses are facing short staffing that has reached critical levels and could compromise their ability to provide the best quality care to their patients. Silento continued, adding, the hospital's treatment of these nurses is proof that all their words of working for healthcare heroes during the pandemic were hollow. Management has offered raises of 19% over the next 3 years as workers have been fighting for raises to meet high inflation rates. Staffing, however, is the highest priority, workers and the union say. Workers say that they're often forced to work through breaks and don't have time for meals. While there are times when one nurse in the emergency department could be responsible for up to 20 patients, according to NYSNA President Nancy Higgins, far higher than the